Natalia Ivanovna Morozova was born the 23rd of June, 1890, in the small village of Yagodnaya, about a half day's carriage ride from the banks of the Volga River and 3 days south of Saratov. Natasha, as her friends and family called her, was the third daughter and fourth child of what would be 7 children total. Her mother, Anya, died giving birth to Varvara, the family's 5th and final daughter, in 1897, leaving her husband, Ivan, the sole guardian of their children. The eldest, a boy named Dima, was only 12 when their mother died, and he became practically the second parent. But Dima was a smart boy and took to his new responsibilities with a somberness that was more befitting a man twice his age. The family worked hard on their farm. Ivan and Dima worked the fields along with the other men in the village, occasionally joined by Natasha's older sisters, Agnea and Olga, when more hands were needed. When not helping in the fields, Agnea and Olga ran the household, with the cleaning and cooking and laundry and sewing and the myriad other small tasks that most people would never think would have to be done until it was time to do them. But the sisters stayed ahead of everything, and because of them, the household ran as smooth as anyone could expect. Natasha herself was tasked with looking after her younger siblings, Vadik, Fyodor, and little Varvara. Ivan had managed to learn to read, something not everyone in Yagodnaya could claim, and he taught his children to read, until Natasha was old enough that she took over the task after his wife had passed. Natasha loved reading, and she loved teaching others to read. When she was little, as she would drift off to sleep, she would dream of teaching her siblings and cousins and neighbors, not just from Yagodnaya, but from all over the Uyezd, to read and write and even do some math. These dreams would always help her fall asleep with a smile in her heart. At the end of every day's labors, as the sun was going down and the family gathered around the hearth for dinners that were modest but never left them hungry, Ivan would tell stories of his own childhood in between the drinks of vodka. Natasha was particularly fascinated by her father's stories of what it was like having been born a serf in 1858, in the very house in which they now all lived together. Even though his family had technically been emancipated in 1861, to hear her father tell it, so little had changed that you barely would have been able to tell. Life for the Morozovs was never easy, but nor was it particularly brutal. Natasha's formative years were spent caring for her younger siblings and teaching them when she could. When they were old enough to take on their own share of the responsibilities, she turned to helping her sisters keep the household. Her least favorite activity was making the textiles for the family and occasionally fulfilling orders from beyond Yagodnaya. It was a dull, monotonous task, and she never mastered the needles, threads, and looms they used. She much preferred raising Varvara, teaching her everything about the house and, sometimes when the two girls were alone, telling her stories of their mother. In fact, Natasha prayed to God in gratitude every night that the death of their mother constituted the only real catastrophe that ever befell the family while they were growing up. Other than minor injuries and occasional bouts of sickness, she and her siblings were always in good health. The harvests were good almost every year, and the village was a calm and idyllic place. Natasha imagined there were worse places to call home. Even though Natasha never seemed much interested in the world beyond her birthplace, there was one intrusion from the beyond she could not ignore: the redemption payments they were all forced to make. Natasha knew it was unfair, and had a quiet disdain for the burden they were forced to carry by the local landlord, an old miser named Mikhailov. But if Natasha had a quiet disdain for the payments, Ivan had an open hatred for them. They were the one worldly affair her father talked about, and he did so often and always with a sneer in his voice. The family's portion of the taxes for which Yagodnaya was responsible, indeed, the taxes that all the peasants of responsible were charged to repay the state, for buying their freedom from the landlords decades ago, when even Ivan was just a small boy. Well, it was difficult to make, but manageable, especially with a large family pitching in. In 1905, when that year's revolution came, it seemed like all the villages in the Uyezd were gripped with a fever, and the Morozov family was not immune. Natasha was 14 at the time, and although she was sharp as a tack, she was loath to concern herself with such grandiose matters. Who cared about a revolution when there was so much work to be done every day? Besides, were their lives really that bad? But her father, after a lifetime of redemption payments and barely eking out subsistence for himself and his children, along with Dima, who loved his father and would have followed him through the gates of hell, and even Agnea and Olga, they shared a different perspective. They would attend regular meetings with their neighbors and friends to discuss what, if anything, they could do about their landlord, for whom they had no love. The redemption payments had finally been canceled just the year before, but Mikhailov had almost immediately raised his own taxes, so that it seemed like no matter how much Yagodnaya produced, there was only ever just enough to keep them fed and clothed, never enough to let them breathe easy. Natasha had never seen her father so animated, and frankly, angry. She'd only ever seen him day in and day out doing what needed to be done to provide for his children. But now, her father's anger bordered on wrath, and it sometimes scared her. But by the fall of that year, the revolutionary fever finally broke, and life seemed to return to what it had been before. Sure, there were now local elections, but those elected never actually changed anything, so they might as well not have been there. In 1909, Natasha married a local boy, Petya, with whom she had fallen in love. Petya was a strong and kind young man, and everyone was sure the couple would be very happy. They wedded right after she turned 19, and for 3 days, the village had taken the opportunity to celebrate with music, drink, and food. Natasha had thought to herself during the festivities that she could not imagine ever being happier than she was right then. Soon after marriage, the newlyweds were pregnant. Natasha had been nervous about bearing children her entire life, ever since Agnea had explained the matter to her the first time she experienced her monthly bleeding. She was terrified of sharing her mother's fate, but as it turned out, the fear was never realized. Just a year after the wedding, the couple had their first child, a boy, whom they named Ivan, after his grandfather. They loved little Ivan very much, and were absolutely heartbroken when, at the age of 2, while Natasha was pregnant again, their son suddenly fell very ill and died inside a week. They had to wait nearly 4 days for the doctor to come from the nearest town, but by then, any autopsy was inconclusive. All they knew was their boy was gone. Years later, Natasha would look back on her son's death as just the beginning of something. For 20 years, Natasha had had a relatively calm, trouble-free life, but she later came to believe with absolute certainty that, starting with little Ivan, God was balancing the scales. Less than 3 months after losing her son, Natasha lost her father at the age of just 55. Ivan, although young, had lived a hard life, and as his children had grown up and become less dependent on him, he had turned more and more to drink. It turned out to be his undoing. Natasha herself gave birth a second time just 2 months after burying her father, but the child, another boy, was stillborn. The village midwife had tried everything, but to no avail. While her heart was still breaking for the loss of her son, her brother Vadik died in a horrible accident working in the forest harvesting timber. Less than 6 months after that, God called Agnea in the same manner he had called Anya, and both Natasha's oldest sister and her would-be niece died in the labor, leaving Agnea's husband, Fama, alone with their two other boys. Although the grief was overwhelming and unending for months, such was life in their village. The work never stopped, and besides, there was little to be done about the loss of her loved ones. Natasha was soon pregnant again. She prayed to God every day that, after losing so much of her family in such a short span of time, this child, at least, would be allowed to stay with her. And then came the war. Officials from the Tsar's government came with proclamations that if everyone in Yagodnoye and every other village across Great Mother Russia fulfilled their patriotic and holy duty before the Tsar and God, Mother Russia would emerge victorious and stronger. God save the Tsar. This all sounded fine and good, but pretty soon, stories began to swirl of the horrific casualties being inflicted on the soldiers, and the unbelievable number of dead. The question on everyone's mind was, would anyone there be called on to serve? Natasha was certain that would not happen. She was with child again, almost due to give birth, and she knew Petya was excited to start a family with her again. Surely, God would not let the war drag on much longer. Surely, the father Tsar would see to it that the war was over by the end of the year, confining the carnage to just a handful of months. One day in November, government officials returned to Yagodnoye, this time accompanied by army officers. They brought with them the news the village had been dreading. More soldiers were needed at the front, and they posted a list on the church walls of the names of the men they would be taking with them in 3 days' time. All that morning, the villagers shuffled through the chill to check the list. Most of them could not read, so Natasha and another young man spent the entire day at the church as their neighbors and friends came to learn of the fate of their men. Out of a village of nearly 300, there were 102 men deemed fit for service. 40 names were on the list. As soon as she had a moment to herself, Natasha read through it. She held her breath as she read, then let out a small yelp when she saw the names of both Petya and Dima. When she got home that night, she shared the news with her family. Petya immediately began reassuring Natasha, saying he would be back so soon it would be as if he had hardly been gone. Dima, who had taken after their father in an angry sense of injustice, could not help but let out a slew of curses. He did not want to fight. He had long ago come to the conclusion that what he and his village needed was to be left alone. No landlord, no tax burden, no war, just the people left to their own devices. For 2 days, Dima talked to his own wife, Fyokla, about how he would refuse to leave. But by day three, a detachment of armed troops arrived to collect the recruits. The village square was full of tears and sobbing on that cold November morning. Natasha hugged Petya so hard, she thought how lovely it would be if her arms became stuck around her husband. Maybe if they said her arms were frozen like that, they'd let him stay. Dima and Fyokla had said their goodbyes at home. She had had 3 days to accept what was happening, and she managed to convince her husband that trying to run away would do no good. It was a coward's way, and they both knew Dima was no coward. But even so, she did not think she could bear watching him leave with the rest of the recruits, and so she stayed behind with their children. Natasha managed also to hug her brother and say her prayer for their safe returns quickly. By noon, all the recruits were loaded into carts and shipped out. Natasha stayed in the square until the cart carrying Petya was out of sight. Brushing away her tears as the wind picked up, she hurried home. There was still work to be done. In mid-December 1914, Natasha gave birth to a daughter, whom she named Masha. Without Petya around, and with no other children, Natasha was grateful for her remaining siblings, Olga, Fyodor, and Varvara, and her nephews and nieces. They kept her company. They watched Masha. And without them, there would have been no way to keep the farm running. As time passed into the new year, A kind of grim fog settled over the hearts and minds of the people of Yagodnaya. Of the 40 men who had been taken in November, none had returned. Nothing was known about what had happened to them or where they were, except for one of them, a 29-year-old man named Gosha. Gosha's parents, Viktor and Tanya, had received a notice and had come immediately to Natasha to ask her to read it to them. Natasha read aloud and struggled to keep her voice steady as she informed the couple that Gosha had been killed defending some position, the name of which Natasha could barely even pronounce. When Viktor asked where that was, she told him honestly she had no idea if it was in Russia or Germany. Tanya had almost started wailing at the news of her son's fate, but had managed through the tears to mumble, "Thank you. God keep you, Natalia Ivanovna," before her husband, himself with a stunned look on his face, had led her away. All that day, as Natasha continued her work, she grieved privately for her neighbors. The Sokolovy had only ever had the one child, and now he was gone. She also thought about how the notice had seemed so cold. Quote, "This message is to inform you that Georgi Viktorovich Sokolov was killed on so-and-so date. He fell in battle defending Mother Russia at a faraway location. His soul is now with God, and the Tsar's prayers are with you." End quote. In three sentences, she had destroyed the Sokolov's entire world. "But I guess," she said to herself, "the army only needs three sentences to do that." That night, she remembered the rage she had seen in her father years ago when she was just a little girl. And to her surprise, although she tried to ignore it, tried to distract herself with Masha and her work, for the first time, she felt that same flame had been lit deep inside her. In the spring of 1915, another company of soldiers came and posted another list, this time of 33 names. There was a lot of angry conversation before the recruits reported to the village square. By then, a few more families had received notices of the fates of their loved ones. The news was never good, and the villagers quickly learned it was better not to receive any news, because then you could still imagine they were alive, they were well, and would one day return to you. But now, the Tsar demanded more of them? Months of preparing for that year's fieldwork, already missing a good number of the men that would have helped, and now, just as the crops were due to be sown, they were losing more? On the night before the recruitment, a meeting was held at the church, where the villagers openly discussed the situation. It was almost decided that they would refuse to turn over their young men, when a knock came on the church door. Before everyone could turn around to see who it was, the doors were flung open. A man with a funny accent, everyone knew immediately he was not from anywhere near Yagodnaya, probably from Tsaritsyna, or maybe even Moscow, marched in with 100 soldiers with bayonets on their rifles. The man identified himself as a major in the Russian Imperial Army, announced he had heard reports of a seditious meeting taking place, and, after a moment of tense silence as he looked around at the faces of the people gathered, declared confidently that he knew nobody here would be involved in any such activities, because everyone there knew the penalties for sedition were severe. After his words, a deafening silence gripped the room. After what felt like an eternity, the major said in a loud but high voice, "I suggest you all return to your homes. Some of you have a duty to the Tsar to fulfill, and the rest of you have a duty to God to let them." With that, the soldiers left. The church was filled with angry whispers, although in the presence of God, nobody dared blaspheme. Soon enough, the villagers started to leave. Natasha had been there for the meeting. She had surprised herself by being one of the first people to suggest a village refuse to give up their men. Now, as everyone filed home, She saw something that was unmistakable. She had felt that night the flame which had been burning in her for months about to erupt from her in hot indignation. Now, as she looked at the eyes of her neighbors in the quickening twilight, she saw reflections of that same flame in them as well. The next morning, Yagodnaya gave up another 33 of its men. The sowing and harvest that year was brutal. With such a dearth of manpower, everyone had to work twice as long to keep the crops from failing, or rotting in the fields before even being picked. Of course, Mikhailov took his portion, but now the Tsar was demanding more for his war. Yagodnaya was known not just for crops, but for some of the best textiles in the region, and Natasha spent entire days weaving and sewing together coats and shirts and pants for the soldiers. She sometimes imagined that the shirt she was sewing would make its way to Petya, or the coat to Dima. Maybe God would allow her to be close to her men in even this small way. Every time she looked at Masha, she thought of Petya. Her heart fluttered, and the flame inside her burned hotter. In the spring of 1916, more soldiers came with more lists. As the list was being posted to the church, the community had gathered around and started jeering the soldiers. The officer in charge, not the major from the year before, looked utterly surprised at this reaction. He appeared fairly young himself, and clearly had not been prepared to be surrounded by angry villagers. He was allowed to leave, but the villagers noticed that when the 3 days were up, the contingent of soldiers come to collect the recruits was this time more than double what it had been. Natasha told Fyodor she was surprised that many soldiers had been available so quickly. She whispered to him her guess that this meant that, as these soldiers had gone around stealing the men from the other villages, they had met this kind of reaction before, and so knew to be prepared. Fyodor laughed back at Natasha as he gestured to the officer from the other day. Apparently nobody told that poor sucker. This time, as the men were stolen away in carts, the tension in the air was palpable. Natasha could see it in her neighbors. A lot of them were trying to figure out if they could move fast enough with their farm tools to get to the padlocks that had been placed on the carts and free the men before the soldiers could line up to open fire on them. Nobody tried it, though. It appeared they had all arrived independently at the same answer. No, they could not. The harvest of 1916 was the worst Natasha had seen in her 26 years. Nobody was surprised. Nearly every man who before the war had spent his time working in the fields had been taken by the war. About half of them had been reported killed to their families, although Natasha counted herself among the lucky ones that she still had no news of either Dima or Petya, and that Fyodor had never been taken from her. But that did not help the problem facing the village of Yagodnaya or the other villages in the Uyezd. They were running out of food. Masha, now almost two, had almost stopped growing for lack of food. When the tax collectors came around this time, they brought with them nearly 200 soldiers. Natasha told everyone who would listen it was because they knew that the people of Yagodnaya would not give up their crops so easily, wary of the hunger lurking. Everyone agreed she was right. As the winter of 1916-17 deepened, the hunger became almost unbearable. There was so little grain to go around that everyone had to content themselves with just a few pieces of bread every day. On Sundays, families would boil meat and cabbage and would drink it down hungrily, picking the bones clean, trying not to mind the slight taste of rotten meat or the faint odor of spoiled cabbage. The villagers tried desperately to fulfill the orders for uniforms and coats, but there was barely any wool left. They themselves were covered in thin rags that hardly kept the cold at bay. The Morozov clan counted themselves lucky. They had 3 decently heavy coats for the whole family to share that winter. but little Masha spent most nights crying for want of something to put in her belly and curled up in her mother's bosom for warmth. As the year 1917 began, the hunger, or the famine, really, because that's what it was, began claiming the vulnerable of Yagodnaya. Natasha heard from the other villages that they were in the same way. Every few days, someone else was found dead, usually from hunger or the cold, or from the disease that had started to creep into the village. Some of the dead Natasha had known, some she had not. But Natasha wept bitterly when Viktor Sokolov, Gosha's father, the one who had asked her to read the notice of his son's death nearly 2 years ago now, succumbed to the hunger. 3 weeks later, his wife, Tanya, was found dead in their house. Without Gosha, and with everyone so hungry and weak, the lack of repairs to the house had left it dilapidated to the point where snow was constantly drifting into the bedroom. That night, Tanya had moved to the kitchen to try to sleep on the table. But it didn't help. The cold took her, and Natasha wept again. In the 2 years since telling Viktor and Tanya of Gosha's death, she had checked in on them from time to time. There really wasn't much time, as the village was being pushed to the breaking point and everyone was working to exhaustion. But she had made sure at least on Sundays to visit them, and whenever she had the ingredients to spare, she had baked just a few meat pies to bring and share with them. Whenever they had it to spare, they would offer Natasha vodka, and the three of them would eat and drink and try to provide a bit of human comfort to each other. Viktor and Tanya had always appreciated Natasha's kindness, and Natasha marveled at the warmth they always managed to show her. It wasn't the fire that was now burning in Natasha and so many others in Yagodnaya. Viktor and Tanya were too old and too broken by the loss of their son to harbor that flame. No, it was the warmth of old. The warmth that the people of Yagodnaya used to share with each other before the war. The warmth that had let you know you were among kin, even if there was not a shared blood relative anywhere in your family trees. That warmth had been one of the last ties Natasha had to what she now called her old life. The life she had had with Petya and Dima, with Ivan, Vadek, and Agnea. But now, Viktor and Tanya were dead. Now, that warmth was gone forever. Just before the winter snows began to melt and the world to thaw, the villagers were bracing for another visit from the soldiers. They had no idea who would be taken this time. Everyone was so weak, even the handful of men who would have been considered fit for service in years past were almost wasted away. But as the spring came in earnest, Yagodnaya saw no soldiers and read no lists. Instead, the village was visited by a group of most unexpected guests. Several young men appeared in the town square one day in mid-March, bearing the almost unthinkable news that the Tsar, Nikolai Romanov, had abdicated? What did that even mean? So, who is now Tsar? What do you mean there is no Tsar? The news of Nikolai vacating his throne, of the workers and soldiers in far-off places like Petrograd and Moscow forming Soviets, of the provisional government declaring itself the legitimate government of Russia, and, most importantly, the promises of a constituent assembly that would be held in the near future. All this took a few days to sink in for the people of Yagodnaya. But pretty soon, they began to realize what this meant. A constituent assembly would be the place to make a push for them to throw off the shackles of Mikhailov and his ilk and take the land for themselves. That would mean no more unfair tax burdens, and no more restrictions on what kind of crops to grow, and when, and what to do with them. If the land was theirs, they would be able to use it to meet their own needs. They would work for themselves and each other, not for greedy landlords and government bureaucrats only out to squeeze the wealth out of the peasants and take it for themselves. As the initial shock wore off, the people of Yagodnaya experienced something one might vaguely recognize as hope, for the first time in 3 years. The young men who had come with this incredible news stayed and began talking to the villagers. They called themselves socialist revolutionaries. Natasha did not quite know what that meant, but the men seemed eager to talk to her and anyone else who had questions. They explained that they were a political party that wanted to help the peasants of Yagodnaya and all over Russia claim the land for themselves. At this explanation, Natasha and the others immediately perked up. The SR men began explaining that a land committee would be set up and would work tirelessly to prepare for the constituent assembly. After a week, the men left to carry their message further, and the people, well, they did not know quite what to think, and so they decided to wait and see what would happen. 2 months later, the men from the SR party returned. This time, they announced the constituent assembly had to be delayed, but that the new provisional government promised to call it as soon as possible. The men begged the villagers for time and thanked them for their patience, explaining that the questions to be decided by the assembly were too important to be rushed. They pled that although the war was going much better now that the Tsar had been removed and the competent ministers of the new government were in charge, victory in the war was needed before an assembly could be called. Soon after they left, the villagers decided this time they would wait no longer. For the first time in her life, Natalia Ivanovna Morozova left Yagodnaya. Along with her fellow villagers, they grabbed their farm tools and hunting rifles and decided to meet their landlord for the first time in their lives. They did not know where Mikhailov lived, but they were certain they would find out. And when they did, they would take back what had been taken from them, what they needed. As the summer of 1917 continued, the news that reached Natasha's ears was exciting, confounding, and at times nonsensical. Some group calling themselves the Bolsheviks had tried to overthrow the provisional government in Petrograd. But of course, the Bolsheviks themselves denied everything. Natasha did not know what a Bolshevik was, but as the year wore on, she heard more and more about them. The men from the SR party never did come back, or if they did, it was when Natasha and the others were on one of their marches across the countryside. In either event, she never saw them again. The raiding of Mikhailov's estate helped the situation in Yagodnaya and the surrounding area somewhat, but the peasants were frustrated and dismayed to learn that the estate itself held very little of the grain and other supplies they sought. Even once they located the granaries and were successful in redistributing some food, it was clear there was much less than had been expected or was needed. While the peasants had survived the hunger of the last winter, they feared that the coming winter would also be worse. Across the entire Uyezd, and even the neighboring Uyezdy, the peasants worked feverishly to sow what they could, hoping it would grow in time for a harvest that would save them. Natasha, in between occasional missions to retrieve grain and supplies for Yagodnaya, feverishly working the fields and helping keep Masha, herself, and her family fed and prepared for the winter, also began paying as much attention to the rumors and news as she could. She began to piece together an idea of what was happening in Petrograd. By September, she realized that the SR party was not going to be the answer to the problems she and the others faced. Plenty of them believed the SRs were still for them, but Natasha and a few others, including her siblings, gave up waiting for them to do what they said they would. Natasha knew the grim truth. The coming winter was going to be devastating. As much as everyone was working, many of the crops had been planted too late in the year. As September progressed, it was all Natasha could do to keep at bay the anxiety, the anger, and the fear, so that she could keep herself and her family afloat. And then, one evening, well after the sun had gone down, as the candles were starting to burn out and the calm of the night was taking hold, a loud knocking on the door of the Morozov house startled Natasha out of the half-sleep she had fallen into. As she got up to see who it was, the door creaked open, and two faces appeared. As she relit candles to see, she froze. The faces belonged to men and were simultaneously jarringly alien and instantly familiar. "Hello, wife," Paethia said. "I'm home." Natasha ran over to her husband and grabbed him. She stared into his face, hidden under a thick, long beard. She could scarcely believe it was him. It had been 3 years since they had seen each other, but it looked like he had aged a decade. He was rail thin, with skin a dark tan. As she reached for his hands, she felt something was different. She looked down and noticed two fingers missing from his right hand. She gasped, and then looked back into the eyes of her husband, and suddenly felt 3 years of loneliness, fear, worry, and doubt leaving her body. Crying loud sobs, she threw her arms around him. She glanced over at the other man who had come with him, even though she knew in her bones already who it was. Her brother Dima, a long scar running down the left side of his face and disappearing beneath a yellow-stained shirt, hugged her, kissing her on the cheek, and let out a long, deep sigh. "How I dreamed of seeing this place again," he cried. As the trio hugged and quietly sobbed, from out of a dark corner of the room came a sleepy voice. "Mom, what's happening?" The three adults turned to see Masha standing there, rubbing one eye and looking bewildered in the other. For a moment, nobody knew what to say. Then, Paethia stepped forward to the daughter he'd known existed but had never met, got down on one knee before her, and, smiling, asked in a soft voice that begged forgiveness, "Good evening, Maria Petrovna. Did we wake you? 1,000 apologies. I am your father." Masha silently watched as this strange man reached deep into a pocket and pulled out a figurine, a horse he had carved out of wood. "I've brought you something for your birthday," he said. In the days and weeks that followed, Paethia and Dima recounted everything they had been through together, how they had been assigned to the same division, the battles they had been through, and how they were both shocked that after 3 years of fighting, the worst that had happened was a scar from debris after an explosion and two fingers that had to be amputated due to frostbite. They had abandoned the front together a month before when they decided together that they were done fighting. Traveling by train, by cart, and by foot, they had made their way back to their home. Everyone listened to their stories, not just the family, but the entire village. In 3 years of war, Paethia and Dima were the only two who had been taken and managed to return. The villagers of Yagodnaya peppered the men with questions. Dima talked openly about how the Bolsheviks had won the majorities in most of the Soviets at the front, and revealed that he had joined their party. He talked on and on about how the Bolsheviks, almost immediately after the Tsar was overthrown, had spoken to the soldiers about one thing and one thing only: the need to end the war. As the villagers listened, murmurs of approval could be heard. "What about us? What do the Bolsheviks plan to do for us?" they asked. Dima proudly announced that the Bolsheviks were promising to do away with the landowners and aristocracy, to give the peasants control over the land. At this, the approval became louder. For days, such conversations took place, until most of the roughly 100 villagers remaining in Yagodnaya talked openly among themselves that they wanted to meet more Bolsheviks, and told Dima that they hoped the Bolsheviks would not let them down. While Dima talked to the village and answered their questions, Paethia, who had always been more taciturn by nature, focused on his family. Masha was at first incredibly shy, having never seen this strange man with only 8 fingers who called himself her papa. She would listen to him and her mother talk and watch him move about the home with familiarity, but she dared not speak to him. As difficult as it was for him, Paethia accepted his daughter's attitude. He had dreamed of nothing but meeting his daughter for almost 3 years, and his instinct was to hold her and never let her go. But instead, he was patient and kind with her. By the fourth day, Masha's apprehension toward the stranger had started to wane. "Are you really my papa?" she whispered, I am, little girl, Petya whispered back with a sly grin. Natasha, meanwhile, was so overcome with relief at seeing not only her husband, but her brother again, that she could hardly function. The fear and loneliness she had held at bay for 3 years finally left her, and it was only then that she acknowledged to herself how rigid and tense she had forced herself to be. Now that she could relax, exhaustion washed over her. For a whole week, she slept better than she could ever remember. When she and Petya were eventually joined by Masha in spending more time together as a family, it was all Natasha could do to keep from openly weeping. As October and the chill of fall approached, the village came to the grim realization that there would soon be very little food. Despite all the sowing, harvesting, and gathering they had done over the summer, even with their depleted population, rationing would be needed. Dima continued to agitate for the Bolsheviks, insisting that the peasants across Russia must join together behind them. He began organizing and leading the foraging into the countryside for stores of grain, and occasionally finding a landlord's estate where they would reclaim the wealth that had been extracted from them. Dima kept calling it surplus value. The villagers called it ours. On the eve of the October Revolution, Natasha fell deathly ill with pneumonia. While she was only 27, the years of stress from overwork and starvation had stripped away her immune system, and to Petya's absolute horror, he watched over the course of a week as his wife seemed to waste away into nothing before his very eyes. Masha understood that her mama was sick and kept trying to comfort her, but both Natasha and Petya would not allow it. Her father explained to her that her mama was sick, and being near her could make her sick, and he did not want anything to happen to her. Masha was sad that she could not hug her mother, but her father was nice and very insistent, so she listened. Petya, meanwhile, spent every moment he could with his wife, who he knew was dying and did not have long. Although he had been away for 3 years, when they had reunited, it was as if they had not spent a day apart, and he had fallen in love with her all over again. He marveled at the strength she had shown in his absence, and thanked her every day for their daughter, promising to take care of her now. On the 21st of October, 1917, Natalia Ivanovna Morozova passed away in the presence of her husband, daughter, and surviving siblings, Dima, Olga, Fyodor, and Varvara. In the end, she was too weak to give any final words, but no words were necessary. Everyone, even little Masha, knew that she had loved them. The following day, she was buried in the village cemetery next to her parents, Ivan and Anya, her sister Agneya, and her brother, Vadek.